credit scores, down payments, interest rates. Car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. Crunch your numbers and get personalized results so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. It's like having a magic wand for your wallet. Presto! The car you've been wanting is now within reach. So hit the road and leave your calculator at home. AutoTrader.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's out there somewhere. And this is Stuff You Should Know, NAACP edition.
That's right.
I was thinking about this while I was researching, Chuck. No one ever says NAACP. I've never heard anybody say it. Everyone says NAACP, which I think kind of gives the whole thing a kind of like an old friend kind of feel to it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, since you brought that up, there have been people questioning the name in modern times of National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Mm-hmm. And some people have floated African American. So NAAA, I guess, could be a way that you would say that. But this was, I think, from 2007. So the leader of the NAACP at the time, I think there's so much in the name, so much currency at this point.
Yeah.
That switching it is kind of tough. Yeah. And also, he said, you know, we're kind of about the rights of many kinds of people. So we don't want to just say African-Americans. So,
yeah.
And there's lots of lengthy articles, but it seemed to make sense.
And from, yeah, actually what I've read is the NAACP is kind of in this lengthy process of kind of reinventing itself or reestablishing itself. And it seems like one of the things that they are starting to kind of go for is especially economic equality for all people. So that right. really kind of jibes with, you know, this, that it's almost like they grew into the name finally now in the 21st century, which is surprising. It's kind of neat.
Yeah. Should we hop back in the old Wayback Machine?
It's been a little while. We got to put some air in the tires first. But yes.
Did we get in that thing at all last year?
I don't think so.
I'm surprised.
Is surprising, you know?
We should have been getting in that thing every day.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we totally didn't. But okay, so here we go. We're getting in the Wayback Machine.
All right. Well, we're going to go back to, let's go back to 1909.
Okay.
We might as well go back to when the organization was founded. Mm-hmm. And the reason why was because, well, for lots of reasons, but I think the sort of inciting incident was in August of 1908 when in Springfield, Illinois, there were two gentlemen arrested on suspicion of rape and attempted rape and murder. And the cops there were a little afraid of what might happen because, as you will see in this episode, there was a tendency for extrajudicial violence, a.k.a. lynchings, to happen if people got worked up. Mm-hmm. So they said, let's get these guys out of here. Let's take them to another town. The mob of people show up and realize that they have been moved and did not take kindly to that and rioted in Springfield.
Yeah, so like as a result of this Springfield riot, there were like 2,000 black residents of Springfield, Illinois, who were displaced. They just didn't have homes anymore because they'd been burned to the ground. Six people were murdered. Two people were lynched. Two innocent men were lynched basically as stand-ins for the two men that they had originally intended to lynch.
Yeah, 16 people ended up losing their lives over those 3 days, and nine black people, seven white people, five died from conflict with the state militia that was called in, and two white people died by suicide. And for many, many years, up until I think semi-recently, the seven white people that died, those deaths were attributed to being killed by black people that were there. And that is not the case. They were literally rewriting history in that case.
Wow. One of the other big things about this, too, is aside from the fact that it happened in this was, you know, these happened with enough frequency like that it was a real problem. But one of the other things about these you know, race riots or massacres of black residents, you know, usually that evolved out of a lynching, was that they went unpunished. Oftentimes they were uninvestigated. There just wasn't much, if anything, done about them. So the kind of it became clear that this was a larger issue. It was already very clear among the African American community in the United States, but it kind of caught the attention of some connected white social justice activists who were working at the time too.
That's right. So in 1909, a man named W.E.B. Du Bois, which is one of the great all-time names.
Oh, yeah.
If you've got three initials and that's what you're going to roll with. And Du Bois is a pretty killer name, too. But he was a humanities professor. He was a writer. He was the first African-American to earn a doctorate degree from a university in the United States.
Harvard, no less.
That's right. He got together with 40 other social activists in New York, and it was, you know, it was mixed races. It was a group of black people and white people, mixed religions. There were Jewish people there. It was described as a group of black and white activists, Jews and Gentiles, in the Library of Congress. And they chose February 12th to get together because that was Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and that is where they established their first charter as a group.
Yeah, the first time they met, they were not considered the NAACP. It wasn't until their second meeting. The first time they called themselves the National Negro Committee. And then in 1910, when they met again, they said, well, let's call ourselves the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And the NAACP was officially born, although they considered the actual founding back in 1909. And like you said, yeah, there was it was multiracial, multi-ethnic. And white people were involved because they were very much concerned about the quality of life and the viability of getting ahead for African Americans in the United States at the time. And for this organization to really kind of find its legs and find its footing and survive its crucial first few years, it needed very well-connected, very wealthy white supporters. And so there was an integration at the highest levels. And then eventually, within a few years, it was kind of like, okay, it's time for us to step back. We've established this thing, and it can kind of go indefinitely from here.
Yeah. So getting back to that charter, I think the words are pretty important. It said it was to promote equality of rights and eradicate caste or race prejudice among citizens of the United States, to advance the interest of colored citizens, to secure for them impartial suffrage, and to increase their opportunities for securing justice in the courts, education for their children, employment according to their ability, and complete equality before the law. And I think it's pretty important because it really kind of laid the groundwork for what I mean, you know, there have been all sorts of activist groups over the years in the African-American community, and theirs was always sort of about, let's attack this in the courts and let's attack these systems in the courts that are, you know, where the cards are so stacked against us by law, and let's get some of these laws overturned.
Yeah, and that's still been their strategy basically throughout. It was the strategy from the beginning, and it still is today, which is not in opposition, but it's complementary to other strategies like direct action, which is like going to a counter and sitting in and protest a segregated lunch counter or not giving your seat up on a bus. During the civil rights era, we'll see, like, the NAACP had an involvement in direct action, but it's always been known as, like, this, like, just shooting for the biggest trophies of all, you know, like change, fundamental change at the national level, legislatively. That's what they've always kind of been about, the NAACP.
Yeah. So some of these, some of the folks in the very first group, the first president was a constitutional lawyer named Moorfield Story, a great man. There was a woman named Florence Kelly, who was also an attorney, who worked a lot in employment reform.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember her from the Frances Perkins episode? She was the woman who inspired Frances Perkins.
I do. She was great.
Yeah, she is great. Who else?
They needed to make some way in the press. That was sort of one of the big problems at the time is, you know, lynchings weren't being covered in the press. A lot of their rights that were being trampled on weren't covered in the mainstream press. So they had a good group of writers, essayists, journalists that would get in there and they would, you know, they founded their own paper, which was huge, The Crisis, which is still around today, mm-hmm. Their magazine, but mainly just trying to get recognized in mainstream newspapers with their work.
Yeah. Again, some of the early supporters and people who were founding members had big time connections in the press. Like one guy, Oswald Garrison Villard, he was the publisher of the New York Evening Post and The Nation magazine. So he could very easily get stories about things like lynchings into his paper and his magazine, where other places wouldn't print that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, as the subscribership of The Crisis grew, it had a bigger and bigger impact. So, yeah, kind of part and parcel, it seemed like, with this legislative action was generating public support through the press. It's kind of like this two-pronged approach.
All right, should we take a little pause for the cause?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break and be right back to talk about some of their early successes right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So if you look at some of the early successes in the first part of the 20th century, one of the big ones you can point to is in Oklahoma in 1910, where they had a state regulation that limited the rights of black citizens to vote. It was a grandfather clause, basically, where they said you need – and I think we talked about this in the voter suppression ep.
Yeah, for sure.
But you need to be able to pass a literacy test in order to be eligible to vote unless – you had a grandfather who voted in 1866.
Right.
And side note, this is before black people were allowed to vote in Oklahoma. So they basically were saying, if you're illiterate and you're white, you can vote. If you're illiterate and you're black, you can't.
Yeah, that Oklahoma law was particularly egregious. It was one of, I think, like 7 or 8 states that had a grandfather clause. But Oklahoma said, not only if your grandfather could vote in 1866, if he lived in another country in 1866 and would have been eligible to vote or could vote in that country, you're grandfathered in. So basically, as long as you weren't black, you could vote, even if you were illiterate. So the NAACP filed suit against this in a very famous case called Gwynne versus the U.S. And Gwynne was named after Frank Gwynne, and who, along with J.J. Beal, were a couple of elections officers who had basically been charged with disenfranchising black voters through the grandfather clause. And the Supreme Court heard this and said, you know what, this is this NAACP group, I've not heard of them before, but they present a pretty good case. So we're going to go ahead and overturn this grandfather clause. And, you know, this was 1915. The NAACP had only met for the very first time 6 years before. And all of a sudden, they're overturning race-based discrimination laws about voting at the Supreme Court. And that definitely caught the attention of people in the civil rights community, for sure.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, it's when you look back through history, this the states' rights argument that we still hear today is such a tricky thing because, you know, states should be allowed to do a lot of things as they see fit, but you can't disenfranchise voters, willfully disenfranchise voters, and that's when the federal government comes in and people start crying foul that they want to be able to run their elections their way.
Right.
Which means we don't want black people to vote. And you just can't do that.
You know, I've been thinking about this recently since we did our Klan episode, because I noticed that every time the Klan went away, it was after the federal government intervened because the states wouldn't, right? And something I came up with, like just a good rule of thumb or a good litmus test, is does this law discriminate against anybody's right? Anybody. It doesn't matter what group it is. Forget the group. Take the group out of it. Is mm-hmm. it a discriminatory law? And I cannot think of a single instance where a discriminatory law would be beneficial for the greater good of the country or for the health of democracy. I can't think of one. Unless you're discriminating against somebody's right to discriminate against somebody, maybe that would be the case. But that seemed to be a pretty good rule of thumb to me that I just came up with. Does the law discriminate? Yes. Well, then it's probably a pretty bad law.
Hey, Josh, 2022.
Yeah, that's about how far into the future I should try my hand at it. 2020.
Man, what is that? What year is that?
I don't know. I don't know, but we're all just basically wisps of ones and zeros, I think, by then.
Another big thing that kind of happened early on, it was we talked about Birth of a Nation in our episode on the Klan. Mm-hmm. And the NAACP got together and said, let's boycott this terrible movie. And the boycott didn't do a lot in terms of shutting anything down in terms of Birth of a Nation, but it did draw them some mainstream publicity and got them written up in newspapers at least.
Right. So, I mean, they had some early successes and especially with overturning the grandfather clause. But I don't know if it was after this or around this time, they really kind of redoubled their efforts back onto the original intention, which was to do something about lynching, to get an anti-lynching law, national federal law, passed in the United States. And what's crazy is that still hasn't happened. And that as recently as June of 2020, we failed to do it yet again, which is just nuts to me. But the NAACP was really trying to get this, to get legislation passed. And, you know, even back then, it just made sense. Now, today, it's just shameful that we don't have something. But the thing that kind of redoubled or refocused the NAACP's efforts on anti-lynching legislation was the lynching of a teenager named Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas in 1916. And even as far as lynchings go, this was particularly gruesome.
Yeah, I mean, not only was the act gruesome, which was he was tortured, hanged, set on fire, and beaten, but it was in front of, estimates range from 8,000 to 17,000 people. Like, basically the size of a small, you know, hockey arena, medium-sized hockey arena.
You're like, I'm not going above medium.
Well, I'm trying to think these days. How much does, like, your average NBA hockey arena hold? Is it more like 20,000?
I'm such a terrible judge of anything like that. So, well, let's just say a medium-sized hockey arena. I think that got it across.
And the only reason I'm saying that is because it's, if you go to a pro sports game or a big concert, try to imagine that many people gathered together to watch a man, a human being, be burned and hanged in front of your face.
Yeah.
And I try to put myself in the, not in the mindset, but out of all those people, like how many of those 15,000 people were 100% fully charged, do this? And how many, as it happened, were like, my God, what has happened to us as human beings and Americans? Like, were there any people there that regretted what was going on?
I'm sure some, and if they didn't regret it during, I'm sure some regretted it afterward. But I think one of the things that made Jesse Washington's lynching so disturbing to the rest of the nation was that it was reported that there was a carnival-like atmosphere where people were enjoying themselves and enjoying their time gathered together with all the other residents of Waco in lynching this teenager. And the NAACP sent an investigator there to basically document the whole thing. And she came back with this report that became something called the Horror of Waco, or the Waco Horror. And the NAACP said, we're going to get this out there. We're going to tell the world about this. And they definitely did. And it had a really big impact.
You know what it reminds me of is the only thing I can compare it to these days is when a high profile death row inmate is executed, and outside the prison they have those parties and stuff.
Yeah,
you know, I don't want to wade into the capital punishment debate here, but there's something about that bloodlust that just feels really gross to me.
Yeah,
and that's my official statement.
When you're talking about somebody's life. And vengeance, anytime vengeance is driving things, it's usually time to take a pause and reflect on what you're doing, you know? I've got all the rules of thumbs coming out today.
Josh 2020-22.
Yeah, that's right.
So they put out these pictures, like you said, were covered in mainstream newspapers. And, you know, I think it shocked the country. Obviously not enough. But it was a big wake-up call, I think, to a lot of people, what happened in Waco. And the NAACP was able to really pivot on this and bring up something like the Dyer Bill, which I think was the first piece of anti-lynching legislation sponsored by Leonidas, another great name, Leonidas Dyer, Republican congressman from Missouri. That died in the Senate. I think it passed the House in 22 and then died in a Senate after a filibuster from the Southern Democrats.
Yes, the Dixiecrats.
And that was just the first of many, many attempts.
Yeah, apparently by the middle of the century, there were 200 anti-lynching bills that were introduced and died in Congress just by the mid-century. And like I was saying, as recently as June of 2020, there was a anti-lynching law that passed the Senate unanimously, 100-0. And then it went over to the House, where it passed 410 to 4. Then the only thing the House did was change the name to the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Law, which means then it had to go back to the Senate to be passed again because that one change had been made. The name had been changed. And when it got back to the Senate, Rand Paul from Kentucky said, I don't feel good about this. Even though he was part of the unanimous Senate that had passed it unanimously just before, and no other change was made except for the name, and that really ticked a lot of people off. But still, to this day, that law was blocked, and the United States still does not have a law that makes lynching a federal crime.
Yeah, so if you want to, I mean, this was really big news, so I'm sure a lot of people know about this, but if you're curious about Rand Paul's defense, was he said, quote, this bill would cheapen the meaning of lynching by defining it so broadly as to include a minor bruise or abrasion. Our national history of racial terrorism demands much more seriousness than that. Mm-hmm. So what he was contending was he wants the language changed because in the language now it says, the standard in federal hate crimes is bodily injury. And I think he wants it changed to serious bodily injury. In other words, if someone gets punched in the face, it would be called and considered a lynching in the way it's written now. And he said there should be substantial risk of death and extreme physical pain in order to qualify as lynching. Otherwise, he said it disrespects what real lynchings were. So take that for what it is. For what it's worth, the Senate formally apologized in 2005 for failing to outlaw lynching. So they apologized in 2005 and still it hasn't been put forward on the books.
Yeah. So the NAACP for decades and decades leading up to the civil rights era was very much focused on preventing lynching, on getting lynching outlawed, on bringing attention to the huge, massive issue of lynching in the United States. They had a flag that they would unfurl outside of their headquarters in New York whenever a lynching was reported. And it just said, a man was lynched yesterday. Which
powerful.
I read it and I was like, wow, that's, you know, that must've been something. Then I saw a picture of it. And it's one of those ones where a picture is worth 1,000 words. Like when you see it, it really drives home what they were doing. And really kind of makes you really like the NAACP, like, yeah, go get them, you know, let's get lynching outlawed.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about the numbers, over that time period, the 4,000 plus comes out to, more than one lynching a week in the United States over that period that was like verified, known, and reported. So clearly, you know, probably more than that. This is happening literally on a weekly basis in the United States. Someone is going out on their own, vigilante style, and hanging, not always hanging a black man, sometimes worse.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you can there were that. Sometimes they would just burn the whole black section of town down. Like in 1917, East St. Louis saw a race massacre, just like there had been in Springfield not too long before. So, it wasn't just lynching. It was just mob violence and enforcement of segregation. I think the thing that set off the St. Louis riot was a black family moved into a white neighborhood, if I'm not mistaken. That was the instance that set it off. So, that was a real problem. Racial violence was an even bigger problem than it is today, back before the civil rights era.
Right. So during the civil rights era, obviously the NAACP is going to be very active. Saw some really great successes there, sort of leading the way, lobbying in the Capitol, trying just scores and scores of cases in the courts, helping people register to vote, taking part in Mississippi's Freedom Summer in 1964. Mm-hmm. If you don't know, if you know the name Rosa Parks and know what she did, you may not know that she was the Montgomery NAACP secretary. Mm-hmm. So she actually worked for the organization.
Yeah, I don't remember. Did we do a whole episode on Rosa Parks and the bus boycott, or was it part of another episode we did?
I can't remember. All of our videos and everything is just a big stew in my head at this point.
Well, we did the one on the Freedom Schools for sure.
Uh huh.
And I don't remember what we did, but we talked a lot about Rosa Parks, and I don't know if it was her own episode or not. If not, she deserves her own episode. But yeah, she was a secretary for the NAACP in Birmingham, or Montgomery, I'm sorry. And if you start to look at some of the big events of the civil rights era, you start to realize that, oh, wait a minute, that was an NAACP field officer, or those people were, members of the local NAACP branch. There were a lot of, like, legal strategies and cases that were launched by the NAACP that appeared to just be direct action, like Rosa Parks had had enough and wasn't going to get up that day, that when you peel back the layer a little bit, this is part of a larger strategy of trying to force lawsuits in court cases so that they can go all the way up to the Supreme Court. And sometimes they were very, very effective.
Yeah. I mean, notably in the mid-1950s, they set their sights on the school system, mm-hmm. and separate but equal. They wanted to take that down. And Brown versus Board of Education, you know, one of the landmark cases in the history of this country, mm-hmm. Thurgood Marshall, an NAACP lawyer, who was actually later on in the late 60s became the first black Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
He argued that segregation in public schools is, I mean, it is flat out very clearly unconstitutional. And this is one of those times where every justice on the court agreed and said, yeah, that is not constitutional in any way.
Right. So I think they said that we need to desegregate with all haste. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was vague enough that
I think it was
like,
lickety split.
Yeah. They're like, what exactly constitutes lickety split? Like, sure, it's faster than a turtle's crawl, but is it as fast as a hare running? And the Supreme Court went, I don't know. But there was a huge backlash to that. It wasn't just like, you know, especially the southern states were like, all right, you know, we had a pretty good run at a segregated school system. It's, you know, it's run its course and now it's time to desegregate. That's not at all how it went.
No.
At the very least, local municipalities and even states tried to come up with new laws that provided loopholes to segregation. Some states said, well, fine, maybe we'll just abolish public schools altogether, and then we don't have to follow this federal law any longer. There was physical violence. There was just a tremendous amount of pushback to the idea of desegregating schools. And the whole thing, like, really kind of found its fruition at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, which was I don't know if it was the first high school to be desegregated, or if it was just the one that was the most nuts, or the first one that was the most nuts. But the governor of Arkansas said, not on my watch, and he called out something like 10,000 National Guard troops to be there on the first day of school, I think September 4th, 1957, to block the entry of the kids who are known as the Little Rock Nine African-American high school students, whose bravery is just breathtaking when you stop and think about it, who were trying to go into this newly desegregated high school to go to class. And they were blocked for something like, I think, 20 days before they could finally make their way in.
Yeah, this was after the Little Rock School Board unanimously voted to integrate their schools. They were going to start with high school that year and then follow the following year with junior high and elementary school. And like you said, those nine, and not only brave kids, but, you know, families of those kids, because they all had to endure what was coming, obviously. They tried, and it got this is the part that's really confusing, because Governor Faubus went to Newport, Rhode Island, to meet with President Eisenhower about this. It's described as a brief meeting, and Eisenhower supposedly thought that Faubus had agreed to enroll these students, mm-hmm. and said that, you know, to go ahead and keep those troops there to keep everything safe. And I don't know if that was a genuine misunderstanding. I read lots of accounts of this, and it seems to have been a misunderstanding. He got back to Little Rock, though, and there was a court order on September 20th from a federal judge that said, you got to get those troops out of there,
right,
and let these kids go to school. And they slipped him in, literally slipped him in the side door, and a full-scale riot erupted. And he, you know, he allowed this violence to happen, couldn't stop it. And they called up for federal help at that time. And that's when Eisenhower had to step in and issue Executive Order 10730, which called in the 101st Airborne.
Yeah.
The white troops of the 101st Airborne, they withdrew the black troops. And they didn't stay there all year, but there were Army units there for the remainder of the academic year.
Yeah. One of the Little Rock Nine was a senior, and he graduated, became one of the first African-American students to graduate from public high school in the U.S., or from an integrated high school. I think four of the eight who didn't graduate were willing to go back the next year. The others were like, forget that, man. This is crazy.
I mean,
like, we literally need the Army to enforce it. Yeah, I mean, one girl was pushed down the stairs. One girl had acid thrown on her face. They were berated and harangued on a daily basis, not just by, like, students, but by parents and stuff. It was just one of the ugliest chapters of American history was desegregation of schools and desegregation in general, but schools in particular, because we're talking about kids here. You know what I'm saying? Kids who are being subjected to that. It's bad enough
stuff
for adults too, but for you know, even teenagers on down, it's just disgusting.
Should we take another break?
Yes.
All right. We are going to take a break, and we're going to come back and wrap it up with the post-civil rights era years and where we stand today with the NAACP right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chuck, the NAACP definitely had a huge hand, along with a bunch of other groups, including the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, just a lot of different groups, to help get some massive legislation passed. And remember, we said from the outset, the NAACP had always been focused on social justice and change and improvement in the lives of African Americans through legislation, through basically federal government intervention, saying, okay, everybody's equal now and we're going to enforce that. And they did it. They got it passed with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, the sweeping reforms that were passed in the 60s, they basically achieved their goal. And what's ironic is from almost that point forward, they were like, okay, well, how do we proceed from here? And there's been a lot of opportunity for people to take pot shots at the NAACP and question the relevancy in the post-civil rights era, which I think when you really kind of dig into it is generally unfair, but in some cases it's been warranted too. And you can make a case that the NAACP is still to this day trying to figure out their bearings again in a post-civil rights era.
Yeah, this kind of started in the 70s when there was a bit of an ideological shift in protest and how that looks. Mm-hmm. And instead of in the courtroom, we did a great episode on the Black Power we did Black Panther, but it was part of the Black Power movement.
Yeah.
And that was a little more in fashion at the time, a little more in your face kind of activism. The NAACP, I think, was sort of looked at a little bit as like, well, no, that's your grandfather's organization.
Yeah, I got that impression too.
Yeah. And like, we want to get up in your face and really make some news and make some change that way. I think revenue stayed pretty high in the mid-70s until they started getting hit with a lot of lawsuits. Mm-hmm. They were always in court defending things as well as trying to get legislation passed and prosecuting things. But that left them on the verge of bankruptcy at one point. There were a couple of high-profile presidents that were fired. There were allegations of financial mismanagement. They had to lay off a lot of its workforce in 2007. And so it's been a little bit tougher road to hoe since the civil rights era. In 2004, the IRS got involved because they are a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And they said, you're supposed to be a nonpartisan group here, and you're saying things, in particular, this speech in 2004, which is pretty much very anti-Bush.
Right.
And you can't do that as a nonprofit. So
right.
It's been sort of a more irregular path that they've been on, and they've been trying to find their way, I think.
Yeah, the NAACP has kind of been stuck in this between a rock and a hard place thing where they're accused on one side of being way too moderate and not nearly active enough. Then on the other side, they're accused of being anti-Republican, you know? And they actually came out against that IRS threat and investigation. I think it was a two-year investigation into whether or not they should hold their 501c3 status. And they came back. They blasted back rather than just kind of taking it. They said, well, wait a minute. This is the Bush administration's IRS saying we shouldn't be talking smack about President Bush or criticizing President Bush. That seems fairly politically motivated. And the IRS ended up dropping that investigation, and they kept their 501c3 status. So good for them on that tip. But one of the other big problems I read, you kind of said, like, there was this, especially during the Black Power movement in the 70s, they were criticized is not being in your face enough, of being just too bureaucratic and slow moving. The same exact accusations are being leveled against them still today.
Sure.
Very much in the face of the Black Lives Matter movement. And one of the big problems that the NAACP has is it's a really centralized organization. There's like, I think, 2,200 branches across the United States. That's a lot of different branches to keep up with. There's a 64-member board. It's amazing that they get anything done. But that huge, that large board has a lot of control over the individual branches. Like, apparently, if you're a branch, if you want to go out and join, like, a march, you know, against the death of George Floyd or against police brutality or something like that, you want to get into the streets, you have to get permission from the NAACP board first. And that board is aging as well. And there's a lot of criticism about it being slow moving, about it being out of touch, and about it being way too bloated a bureaucracy to have a big impact like it needs to have on the immediate lives of Black people and people of color in general today. So there's a huge transition that the NAACP is undergoing right now. And I don't know that they have found their way, but they seem to be rather aware that they do need to find their way again. Because it's an organization that depends largely on membership dues. And if people think you're irrelevant or don't even realize you're still around, they're not going to join and give you membership dues. And it's going to make it harder to actually get anything done.
Do I need to say it?
Please do.
Josh Clark, streamline, get rid of that red tape. Josh Clark, 2020-22.
Instead of like that Nixon like peace sign for victory thing, I'm going to somehow replace my fingers with all thumbs. This is going to be like rule of thumbs every which way.
I love it. In 2011, NAACP really kind of formalized their march into the 21st century. I guess about 11 years too late. Not too late, but calendar wise. And they said that their focus were what they call the six game changers, which right now are economics, sustainability, education, health, public safety and criminal justice, voting rights and political representation, and youth and young adult engagement. And they're still at it. These days you can see them protesting, litigating, lobbying. It might be over Confederate statues in public squares.
Mm-hmm.
It might be in the form of doing a sit-in in the office of former Attorney General Jeff Sessions. It might be, you know, reaching out to Black Lives Matter and people who are part of that organization to see how they can work together. They're trying. They're doing their best. I think now it's about 500,000 members, about $29 million as an organization. And what did you say? It's more than 2,000 branches?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, that's a big lumbering organization, you know?
It is.
One of the other problems I saw that they were running into was that, like I said, they were kind of victims of their own success. When you're agitating for legislation, when the legislation gets passed, what do you do next? And one of the things that the NAACP is credited for is paving the way for African-American office holders. And I was reading something from Juan Williams, who I guess is conservative now. He defected from NPR over to Fox years and years ago. But he was saying that the irony of the election of Obama and other Black office holders is that it makes the NAACP seem less relevant, because then people say, okay, the NAACP got these guys into power, and now we can rely on them to make the changes that the NAACP has been trying to make. And so it's kind of like, yeah, they've achieved the changes that they've wanted to, but now they have to figure out, okay, what's left? What else needs to be focused on, and how do we change that following the course that we've plotted in the organization that we've structured for ourselves? So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what the NAACP does over the next like 10 or 20 years.
I think the six game changers is a pretty good foundation.
I agree. So huzzah to the NAACP. We're glad that we live in a world that they're around, although we're sad that we live in a world where they're needed, you know?
Wow, boy. Do I need to say it?
I just grew an extra thumb, I think. Okay, well, since Chuck just laughed like that, I think everybody, it's time for listener mail.
This is from a six-year-old. And if you want to get on listener mail, just be six.
Mm-hmm.
That's my advice.
Yeah.
Hi, Josh and Chuck. My name is Christopher. I'm 6 years old and from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. My mommy introduced me to your show recently because I'm very interested in learning about everything, and I love your podcast.
Cool.
This kid is like basically my daughter's age, by the way, who could not care less about what I do. Well, that's actually not true, but she certainly doesn't listen.
Okay.
I had a movie crush on the car the other day. She said, "Is that Josh?"
No, she didn't. That's awesome.
I can't remember who I was interviewing, but
did she say that every time?
No.
Yeah.
She wondered if it was you.
Was it Mark Ruffalo? Because people say I sound like Mark Ruffalo.
No, but he tweeted about us once, didn't he? Trail of Tears?
Yeah. No, Navajo Code Talkers.
Okay. Yeah. You need to get him on the show.
Yeah, you do.
I really like the episode on origami. It's one of my favorites. I also really like the one on Monopoly and also the one about peanut butter. I think the more I listen, the more favorites I'll have. Have you done an episode on Harry Potter? If you haven't, maybe you should. I'm reading through the books now with my mommy. It's adorable. I'm hoping that you might read my letter on listener mail and I'll get to hear it. If you do, can you tell me which episode? But if not, that's okay. I just want to let you know that I think you guys are really interesting and smart. Love, Christopher McElturin. And then get this. My mom had to type this for me, but I told her what to write.
Very nice. Dictated by Christopher. Wow. That's pretty great. Thanks a lot, Christopher. We appreciate you. We have not done a Harry Potter episode, but maybe we will someday. And if we do, it will be because you asked for it. How about that?
Great.
And Chuck, we just got to introduce a six-year-old to the history of the NAACP.
I love it.
Yeah. So if you want to be like Christopher and get in touch with us and tell us that you're six, you better be six if you say that. You can hit us up via email at stuffpodcasts@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.